Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everyone. This is Dr. Jeanette Parker, medical whistleblower, coming to you live from Lawrence, Kansas. As many of our listeners already know, Medical Whistleblower is an advocacy network for those who report problems within the medical community, whether those problems are abuse and neglect of patients, medical fraud that impacts vulnerable populations, or human rights violations. Tonight we are focusing on the human rights aspect of our work, and we are very privileged to have two volunteers, Brenda Daldorf and Sonia Navarro.
Brenda Daldorf.
And Sonia Navarro. Sorry about that. From the No More Deaths organization. These two young women, who are students at University of Kansas, have been directly working with No More Deaths to end death and suffering on the U.S.-Mexico border through a new civil initiative. The mission of No More Deaths began with the conviction that people of conscience must work openly and in community to uphold the fundamental human rights of people. It was a morally intolerable situation, which was inspired a remarkable humanitarian movement in southern Arizona in the spring of 2004. Driven by the economic inequality and thwarted by ill-conceived U.S. border policy, the immigrants were ignorant of the harsh conditions of the Sonora Desert, and more than 2,000 men, women and children have died trying to cross the Mexican border into the United States since 1998. This information was brought to light by the No More Deaths organization, which were documenting deaths that occurred in the brutal heat of the summer months. The No More Deaths Initiative is a diverse faith-based and social activist group network, along with concerned individuals that felt compelled to stem the deaths and to attempt to save at least some lives. The result was a converging of hundreds of volunteers, local, regional, and national people, who came together to work for one common goal, no más muertes, or no more deaths. The work focuses on direct aid that extends humanitarian assistance, as well as witnessing, responding, raising global awareness, and documenting problems along the border. So today we have two very wonderful No More Deaths volunteers. Sonia Navarro is currently an AmeriCorps member in Lawrence, Kansas. She is working as the wellness coordinator at the Heartland Medical Clinic. She is a student at the University of Kansas studying human biology and psychology and will graduate in December of 2009. So that's coming up soon.
Yeah.
She has applied to medical school, so she's interested in medicine. And she was hoping to study internal medicine and worked with underserved populations. She's been very concerned about reducing health disparities in the United States. And she is actively involved in community and on campus, serving as a member of the board of directors of the Douglas County AIDS Project, the president of the Service Learning Ambassadors, and coordinator of the Hawks for Health, to name just a few of the commitments that she holds. She says she's passionate about immigration reform, and she first volunteered with No More Deaths in the summer of 2009. She is hoping to return next summer and to stay for a longer period of time, and hoping at that time to raise awareness about immigration issues and to allow her community and people in Kansas, and I assume all over the world, to understand a little more about this organization. Are you there, Sonia?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay. Well, Sonia's not the only volunteer we have today. We have Brenna Daldorf. I hope I said that right this time, Brenna.
You got it. Thank you so much.
Oh, yes. She is a senior at University of Kansas and is going to graduate in May of 2010 with a degree in journalism and French. Elle parle français. Since first volunteering with No More Deaths, do you speak Spanish too, Brenna?
I'm learning Spanish.
Spanish would be probably very helpful on the border. Since volunteering with No More Deaths as part of an alternative break in the spring of 2009, Brenna has devoted herself to raising awareness about the issue of immigration. To that end, she has given lectures, radio interviews, organized a gallery exhibit of border art at the Spencer Art Museum, which is right here on the at the University of Kansas, taught children's seminars, and she also led a second student trip to No More Deaths in August 2009. And she is leading a trip to raise awareness of immigrants' rights in Chicago this January. Ultimately, Brenna hopes to be a reporter specializing in issues of immigration. This summer, she took a step on this path while interning for a small Chicago-based paper called Streetwise, which is sold by vendors who are homeless or at risk of being homeless. Brenna produced two cover stories for the magazine on homelessness in immigrant communities, and one of those stories was later placed on the International News Network. Brenna hopes to continue to influence both public opinion and policy about immigration through her media work, and she also hopes to study media and development at the London School of Economics in the fall. And so we are very pleased to have these dedicated young college students helping us understand this very important issue about human rights for those who are immigrants who are trying to cross our borders. So with no further ado, I'd like to allow our two experts tell us a little bit about their experiences. Why don't you start, Brenna?
Right. Wonderful. Well, the way that we'd really like to start out our discussion today is by telling you a story of a family that we met when we were at No More Deaths working there this summer. The people at No More Deaths work from a camp based in the desert, and what we're doing is providing humanitarian aid to the migrants that cross this area, and we'll give you a little bit of background on that later in our discussion today. But just to start out, when we were there this summer, we saw an increased number of women and children who were crossing. And one instance of this was a family that a group of No More Deaths volunteers met. This family was not doing well. They had been told that the journey across the Sonora Desert would take them 2 hours if they were fast, and potentially 4 hours because they had children with them. And this was told to them, they said, 4 days ago. They had been wandering in the desert, lost for 4 days. When our volunteers came upon them, the two women had drank water that was pond water, and so it had caused them to throw up and had made them very sick. The children were okay. There was a 16-year-old and a 7-year-old boy. And the father was okay, but the two women were very sick. So we brought them back to our camp. They had wanted to turn themselves into Border Patrol, and we told them that one of their options could be contacting the embassy and seeing if they could potentially get asylum, especially because they had children with them. And so they agreed. They decided that this was a good option for them, and we brought them back to the camp so that we could give them immediate medical care. We spent a lot of time interacting with this family at the camp, and I spent a lot of time playing with the little boy. His name was Christian, and he was 7 years old, which is just about the same age as my little brother. And we played lots of games on the kind of dusty courtyard in the center of the camp. And one day we had been playing soccer, and he got tired, and we sat down on the ground, and he started drawing lines in the dirt. And pretty soon he had walled me off. He had drawn a box around me, and he told me that I couldn't cross the lines. And I realized that he was playing border guard with me. And I told him that, you know, these lines weren't good, but it was so striking because this was his reality, you know, and this was a little boy trying to deal with the fact that his family had come over the border, had, you know, hoped for something. He had understood that there was a wall separating them from here. And so that was one of the most striking experiences for me this summer. Sonia, tell a little bit more about the interactions that you had with the family and what happened to them.
I was at camp when the family first got there, and it actually was in the middle of a monsoon that had just started, so it was pouring down rain. And I remember I was hovering under the tent trying not to get wet, and one of the volunteers came up to me and said that she had brought back 6 people that they had found in the desert. So we immediately started working, trying to get them just a warm place to be in and dry. We had a medical tent set up, so we got them in there, but since there was 6 of them, we had to kind of clear out some space and get some cots set up for them. And I remember that they were all really scared, and they were hungry, and they were thirsty. And like Brenna said, the women were sick. They weren't feeling well. We got them hydration packs and water and various things like that. And within a couple hours, we were all talking and laughing. They were still clearly scared and worried about their children. But, I mean, they had really high spirits. I was really moved by the attitudes that they had and the friendliness and everything, the way that they acted towards us. One really funny thing is the next morning, everyone had gone out to patrol, and I had stayed at camp, and I was helping them pick out shoes and clothes. And Christian, the 7-year-old, he picked out some cleats. And he thought they would be really good because they wouldn't hurt his feet when he was walking, and they would give him traction because he said that he had fallen a few times while they were walking and trying to climb in the desert. So like, he loved the cleats. He hoped that they would fit him. So he went and ran and tried them on, and they fit. So he seemed so happy. Like, he was really happy to have the cleats. And another funny thing is the women, I was trying to pick out shirts for them to wear with some tops. And I picked out this top, and I was like, oh, this is really cute. And they both looked at each other, and then they looked at me, and they started laughing. Then they said that they thought it was ugly, that they didn't like it, but they thought it was funny that I liked it and tried to pick it out for them. And I just had many interactions with them, getting to know them, talking to them. And the more time I spent with them, the harder it was, because I was starting to realize that probably wasn't anything the consulate was going to be able to do for them. It was such a large group, and there were so many of them, that to be able to offer asylum to 6 people, 2 different families and another gentleman, it just wasn't going to be possible for them. So what they ended up doing was calling Border Patrol, and basically from there we don't know exactly what happens to them. We have an idea, but it's basically only a guessing game because there are so many different ways that it can work out. They can be taken back to Mexico, you know, they can go to court, they can be arrested, the families can be separated. We just really don't know what's going to happen to them.
What's the current border situation, Brenna?
Yeah, well, that's a good place to start. Now that you've heard this story about the family, I can really give you some context for everything that's happening and kind of why No More Deaths exists within that context. If you look at the region of the Southwest United States, historically, the border has not really been anything real. It's been a very fluid area. There's always been labor force going back and forth. There's been families that are spread across the border. If you look even in United States history at immigration quotas that were happening in the 1920s, they were mainly restricting immigration on the East Coast and the West Coast. They never said anything about the Southwestern area. it was just kind of allowed to be fluid. Native American groups in the region, for example, could choose their citizenship, whether they wanted to be Mexican or whether they wanted to be American. Then really in the latter half of the past century, you see the border particularly starting to be more built up, starting to be more militarized. And when that really takes shape is in 1994. And that was when a specific program called Operation Gatekeeper was put into place. Now, Operation Gatekeeper started to make border security, our border with Mexico, into a national security issue. And so at this time, you start to really see a huge bulk of money fused into the border of personnel. Now, before this date, even though the border had started to be more built up, as I said, in the latter half of the century, migrants were still coming from Mexico, and they were coming usually in urban areas. You have about 70% of people crossing in specific points, one of which was Juarez, El Paso, another one, Tijuana, San Diego. But with this change, with Operation Gatekeeper, one of the first things that was put into place was a policy called prevention through deterrence. Now, this idea was that resources and personnel were going to be concentrated in these urban crossing areas. And the whole idea behind this policy was that if we build up all this personnel in these areas, we're going to force people to make the crossing in places that are terrible and that are very difficult to cross. For example, the Sonora Desert. This is kind of the beginning of the story that we come into play into. And so there was actually part of this, in the statement, prevention through deterrence, a kind of allowance that people were going to die, but hopefully it was going to be a lesson that would slow down Mexican migration. Now, the problem with this whole plan is that it dealt with none of the actual factors that cause migration. There are so many reasons why people move northward from Latin America and from Mexico into the United States. At the root of this is economic inequality. But there's also an entire myth, an entire belief system based on opportunity in the north, in El Norte, a kind of idea that you can succeed if you go north, and that at least opportunities are better there, and in some ways they are, especially if you consider the current Mexican political state. Now, we also have to remember the impact that our foreign policy and our economy has had on Mexico. Also in the 90s, you have NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreements, and what this was supposed to do was really facilitate market exchange between countries in North America. And what we have is business going across borders, yes, but no allowance of labor, no kind of revamping of our visa system, which is in fact very outdated. And so what we started doing was exporting American companies to Mexico, flooding their markets with our products, for example, corn. And what you have is a lot of people in especially southern regions of Mexico, Oaxaca and Veracruz, no longer being able to afford these basic amenities and being put out of business. And so you really see that our foreign policy has had a huge impact on the amount of migrants that are coming. Many are from from Central America, countries like Honduras and El Salvador and Guatemala, and many are from the far south of Mexico. So you have these people coming forth, and suddenly there's a lot more personnel. It starts to be impossible to cross in these city areas, or at least very, very difficult. And you might think, as the government did, that this would stop people from crossing. But as I said, none of this policy actually affected the reasons that people crossed. So as I stated earlier, before, about 70% of migrants were crossing in these traditional urban crossing points. Well, now what do we have? We have 64% of people making the crossing in non-traditional areas. We're talking about the Sonora Desert. And this hasn't slowed people down. 400,000 people have come across just the Tucson sector yearly. The New York Times recently stated that if you look at all of the Mexican immigrants in the United States, 49% have crossed since the year 2000. But what we have seen a change in, so really no change in migration, but what we have seen a change in is number of deaths. This is because the people are suddenly pushed through these very dangerous regions, regions like the Sonora Desert, which we'll explain to you a little bit later what the kind of conditions are that people face. We've had 2,000 deaths since the early 90s. This year alone, 189 bodies have been found. And one statistic that's very often stated is that usually only about 1 out of 10 bodies are found because the conditions are so bad out there and you aren't exactly doing body retrieval in the Sonora Desert. So just think about that. This year alone, 189 bodies. So that's a little bit of the context that No More Deaths came into.
Well, Sonia, can you tell us a little more about No More Deaths, the organization itself? What
are
they?
This is kind of a grassroots organization that started in the spring of 2004. There was just these groups of people, some organizations, some individuals, and they just realized that the things that were going on were just not good, and they wanted to do something about it. Like Brenna said, there was, since 1998, there were more than 2,000 deaths that they know of people trying to cross the border. So basically, their mission is to end death and suffering along the U.S.-Mexico border through civil initiative, which they define as the conviction that people of conscience working openly and in community to uphold fundamental human rights. So the right to live, the right to improve your life and provide for your family, you know, things like that, things that we take for granted every day.
They're using
right to provide humanitarian assistance. So, you know, they provide water, they provide medical assistance, things like that. They also witness and respond. So they see how immigrants are treated. They respond when they're treated in wrong ways. They try to do things to protect their rights. If they see immigrants that are being held by Border Patrol, they'll try and offer water if they can. They also try to raise consciousness, so they just get the word out there. They try to get these issues into the minds of people in the U.S. and also in people in Mexico, because one of the major problems is that people don't know the conditions of the desert. They don't know how far it is to Tucson. They don't know how large the desert is, how long it would take them to walk. Things like this, they just don't know. And also encouraging humane immigration policy, so changing laws, changing policies, trying to make a real impact on border reform and border issues, and maybe, you know, reworking Operation Gatekeeper and laws like that have been put into place. And also on the border, they've seen a huge increase of families crossing. It's not just men now that are trying to go find jobs and then send money back to their families. It's whole families. It's women. It's young children. It's women that are pregnant. You know, all these people are crossing the border. And also, people are crossing in the middle of the summer where it's really hot. The desert's a hot place as it is. There's not a lot of water. So in the middle of the summer, you know, the conditions are the worst, but that's also the best time to cross because at night it's not too cold where they, you know, some people die in the cooler months at night because it's so cold at night. You know, you would never think that someone might die of hypothermia in the in the desert. And also, like Brenna talked about, why people cross, No More Deaths tries to look into those reasons. You know, why are people crossing the border? Why are they risking their lives to come to the U.S., especially with our economy the way it is? You know, they're still crossing.
So we want to point out that this has to do with human rights as defined by the United Nations. And for those of you familiar with our work, Just to add a little bit to this very moving story we're hearing from these two volunteers. The rights that we are talking about are those that are guaranteed to all human beings by the treaties that were ratified by the United States. And the principal treaties among these are the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, ICCPR, and the Convention Against Torture and Other Cruel, Inhumane, and Degrading Treatment or Punishment, the CAT Treaty. And these treaties were ratified by the United States, and they are binding, cause binding obligations, and have become the supreme law of the land, because these international treaties actually are above the U.S. Constitution in the hierarchy of laws. And those of you who are medical whistleblowers, you're probably aware that we have a number of medical whistleblower canary notes on these treaties and their implications to us as medical professionals. One of the universally recognized rights are the rights to be treated humanely and with respect and human dignity. The treaties state that there is an inherent dignity to the human person. The other right that's very important is the right to due process of law, and I know these young ladies are going to talk a little later about how the immigrants are treated in the legal process after they have been held and detained. And persons who are not American citizens do not have the same access to the courts as those who are citizens. But under the international law, detention must never be arbitrary. It has to be done according to existing laws and legal process. And there is a fundamental right to liberty. All detained persons are entitled to judicial process. And they need to be informed of the reasons for the detention, have the ability to make the proceedings before court without delay, so not be held arbitrarily for long periods of time, be given a fair trial by a competent and neutral court, and have the opportunity to present evidence. And this also means the ability to understand the proceedings that are happening around them, in other words, the ability to have a translator to assist them in this legal process. They also have the right to not be subjected while they are being detained to cruel, inhumane, or degrading treatment and punishment. And so we do need to make sure that severe pain and suffering, whether physical or mental, is not intentionally inflicted on a person. And especially not for purposes of getting them to confess or punishing them for an act he or a third person may have committed or suspected of committed. So that's under the CAT, C-A-T, convention. And, of course, we also have protections under the 5th, 8th, and 14th Amendments of the U.S. Constitution for persons. So those, and I'm sorry to have jumped in on you here, Sonia. So if we can go further, can we talk a little bit about what the volunteers do, Brenna?
Yes, absolutely. Sonia started to introduce it, but I can tell you a little bit more about the actual on-the-ground work that, for example, we found ourselves doing. And, you know, this is just people, you know, like you and me. I'm just a college student, and so Sonia and we were out there doing this, so... What volunteers basically do is we'll go out several times a day on what we call patrols. And now a pretty amazing man who worked with No More Deaths put all of the migrant trails that we know around the area into a GPS system. And so we go out with a GPS. If at all possible, we go out with a trained medic or someone who has taken first aid, wilderness response. And then we also always have a Spanish speaker with the group in order to be able to talk to the migrants. And then after that, you're out on the terrain, and what you're doing is you're carrying water, walking on these trails, which, by the way, are just about the most remote places that I've ever been. I mean, the camp itself is, you know, you go south of Tucson for about an hour, and then you turn off onto side roads, and then from a tiny town there, you go onto more side roads, and that's where you'll find the camp. And then when we go out for patrols on the day, during the day, you go even farther, drive maybe an hour, maybe 40 minutes or a little bit less on very, very rough roads to get out to the starts of these migrant trails. And that's when you start to really realize the kind of conditions that people are being pushed into. You know, something I didn't bring up earlier, but I think something that is very worthy of note is that there really aren't very many Border Patrol agents in this area just because it's so rural. You know, and the number of migrants that have been caught in these areas have actually decreased, though the number of deaths have increased by quite a striking number. So families like the family that we introduced later, even though they were ready to turn themselves in, you know, the women were sick, they just couldn't think about going on at this stage. Even if they had waited by the side of the road for days, perhaps nobody could have ever found them. You know, we often have Border Patrol officers who won't be able to locate us if we have a migrant. We've had Border Patrol, we've had ambulances stop at our camp for directions in this kind of area. So anyway, that's the kind of terrain we're going out into. What we do is we carry water. And we also will carry food with us sometimes and travel with, as I said, either a medic or at the very least a medical supply kit, a backpack full of medical supplies. And then you're out walking the migrant trails, and I think I'm going to just take a moment here to describe what the trails are like because it fits in so well with what I'm talking about. But you know, this is very rough terrain. As Sonia introduced, it's not what you would expect the desert to be. I mean, I imagined, you know, kind of my vision of the Sahara, you know, desert sand dunes or something like that. Well, that's not this at all. It's very mountainous, very hilly. There were times when I was carrying water out on these paths, and I would literally have to lie down and sort of scoot down these cliff faces because there was no way that I could stay on my feet, and even using my hands I could get down this area. You know, and that's a big problem for crossing migrants. It wears people out if they don't have adequate footwear, which is often the case just because so many people are unprepared going into the desert. There's a high likelihood of falling or blisters, and it makes everything very difficult. And then, of course, you have the climate issues. You have the heat, you have the cold, you have monsoons, as we brought up. You know, really, everything is against you. One of my favorite authors who wrote about the desert, Luis Alberto Urrea, once said that everyone is an illegal immigrant in the desert, and that's really how you feel. So in any case, when we walk these trails, we do one of two things. We will leave the water at specific drop-off points that are mapped on the GPS system. And that's in the hopes that someone will come along these paths, and if they need water, then they'll pick it up, or food, then they'll pick it up. And we also collect the bottles that we find along the trail that people have left, you know, and take note of which trails are being used and which aren't so that we can provide water. That's also a lot of going out on the trails is observing where people go so that you can be the most help possible. Now, if we encounter an individual, that's the second part of our work when we're on the trails. Of course, we offer them the same thing. We offer them food and water. And these are, as Sonia mentioned, things that we believe can be done and are legal under the law, acts of civil initiative. The stated thing that we cannot do is to aid or abet a migrant. But what we can do is we can save their life. And so we can give them food, we can give them water, we can give them medical attention, and we can also give them a sense of orientation because the area that they're in from the border to Tucson is something like a 4-day walk if you're doing well. The issue is that no one can carry enough water to make it all the way to Tucson. And so for that reason, we have to let them know where they are just so that they'll survive. And so that's something else that we do. While we can't give them a map, because that would be considered aiding and abetting a migrant, what we can do is show them their orientation on a map, point them out where a migrant trail or a highway might be, tell them which is north, which is south, those kinds of basic things, because it's very, very easy to be disoriented and lost, and that is what causes the highest rate of death, you know, just having no idea where to go. And so that's kind of what the on-the-ground work is, you know. Sometimes it happens that you run into people, sometimes not, but what always happens is the water has been taken or has been drunk and you're picking up bottles, just because of the high amount of people, just in the Tucson sector alone. So just in the area of the border south of Tucson, about 1,000 people cross every night. And so when you think about all of those people passing by, you know, and you see all the water bottles, all the things that they've left behind, then you really know what we're doing.
Well, that's very, very, very compelling testimony. What kind of medical care can you provide with no more deaths? Sonia?
The medical care is kind of limited, though there are doctor and nurse volunteers that work with No More Deaths. Like Brenna said, a lot of the time, sometimes it's just a medical volunteer that's CPR or first aid certified, or maybe a wilderness first responder. But they can do a lot of the basic things that turn out to be just what migrants are needing. You know, treatment for dehydration. Usually they have pretty bad blisters. Some of them don't have terrible blisters, but just need clean socks or even dry socks. So that's one of the other things that we try to carry out on the trail with us is packs of socks. It's always heartbreaking when you go out and people need socks and you don't have them. So that's one thing we learned to always carry with us. They can also do treatment for wounds, just basic kind of wounds, cuts, scrapes, people have fallen. I know of twice that No More Deaths officials have delivered babies out in the desert, which I can't even imagine what that must have been like. And also like the two women that we met at camp that had drank out of a pond. There's stock tanks all over the area where we volunteer just because there are so many cattle out there. And that's one thing that I didn't really expect either. There are these giant stock tanks all around the area, and people find them, and that's the only water that they have, and they don't know when their next water will be, so they drink it. Just depending on how sick they are, depends if we can provide any kind of treatment for that. If people are seriously ill, though, usually No More Deaths officials have to call Border Patrol just because they don't have the resources or the ability to be able to provide them the medical care that they need just because they are out in the middle of the desert.
So what is your relationship with Border Patrol?
Relationship with Border Patrol seems to be different depending on who the volunteers are. The relationship is kind of a trustful relationship in that we know we can call Border Patrol, and if we need them to be there, they'll show up just because that's their job. I think they have had some problems with Border Patrol raiding camp. And also they've had problems with Parks and Wildlife giving out tickets for littering. But the relationship does seem to be a positive one. They seem to understand that is their job and they're doing their job. And they see us. They saw us many times when we were on patrols. And they would wave, they never tried to stop us or anything. So the relationship seems, while
it's
not
cordial,
probably a friendship, it does seem to be a working relationship.
I think if I could just jump in and say a little bit more about that, I think it is also quite dependent on the individual in both cases, the No More Deaths volunteer and also the Border Patrol agent themselves. Because there have been very negative instances in the past between No More Deaths volunteers and Border Patrol, some volunteers do have very negative connotations. You know, we've had specific human rights issues when a migrant will be picked up and they won't be allowed to keep their food or water. And so I think one tendency is to paint all Border Patrol officers as bad. And I think that one thing that, you know, you really have to understand in this context is that when we beefed up Border Patrol, we didn't necessarily take time to properly or adequately train these Border Patrol officers. So a lot of them are going into the desert pretty unprepared. You know, like I mentioned earlier, some of them end up asking us for directions. A lot of them aren't from the region and so might not know the conditions, might not know the roads. And so within that, you know, it's really up to the individual officer how they're going to rise to the situation. You know, we do have guys that don't treat migrants particularly well, instances of abuse, instances of being rude, of challenging No More Deaths volunteers. But that's not, you know, while that I think is probably the most popular opinion out there, that sort of border wars, No More Deaths versus Border Patrol, you know, that's not really the case. And we have had some, like Sonia said, very positive interactions with specific officers, you know, officers that thank us for doing our work. One thing, though, that has been a problem of late is that while there is a Border Patrol medical unit, BORSTAR, if we have a very injured migrant, we'll notify Border Patrol and we'll also notify the local ambulance. Although sometimes we'll talk about getting a migrant to a hospital, you know, sometimes only the Border Patrol agent will be sent. And after that, you know, we don't really have any assurance that the migrant will be getting the medical attention that they need. We'd like to hope so, but we don't always know. And so that's one thing that you do always tell the migrants when they're being picked up is, you know, please insist that you see a physician if they're doing very badly, because, you know, transport of migrants isn't the easiest thing. And there have been instances of people needing medical care and being, you know, very slowly transported to medical care. So I think the relationship with Border Patrol is very complicated, very complex, and you can't really say whether it's positive or negative because it depends on the case. There used to be more trust, I think, in the past than there has been lately.
Now, No More Deaths documents, the volunteers document migrant abuse, and some of that migrant abuse can be at the hands of their own coyotes. Do you want to speak on that, Brenna?
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. You know, there's just so many impacts of militarization of the border. As Sonia said, more families are crossing because it's not as fluid anymore. It's not like you can just return back. One of the biggest things that we've seen is a border industry emerge, you know, and within that, probably the most prominent role is played by the coyotes, the quiotes. And a coyote is someone who is a paid guide to take people across the desert. And, you know, once again, you can't blanket classify all quiotes as bad, but we do have a lot of instances of pretty terrible treatment of migrants by their quiotes, who are quite often connected to drug cartels, or you know, could just be individuals working on it. But in any case, we've had a lot of issues with that and abuse cases that have come to us that migrants will later report. I think one is just in such an incredibly vulnerable position when in the desert. You know, these migrants are coming from so far away. You know, first of all, the desert isn't welcoming to anyone. But for a lot of these people that are coming from, you know, El Salvador, Guatemala, or way southern Mexico, this is just landscape they've never seen before in their life. You know, it's just as far of a journey as me going down there from Kansas.
I have a caller here on the line. Can we take a phone call?
Yeah, and then I can jump back a little more about Quixote's after, if you'd like.
Yeah, caller, you're on the line.
Hi, how are you doing?
How are you doing?
Well,
do you have a question for one of us or all of us?
Well, you know, I really respect your view on the board, you know, no more deaths, no more violence, but if you really want to get something down, you need to blow some heads off. You want these fucking sticks coming up from the border and fucking bukkaking all our children and all the sick shit that they fucking do, you know?
I don't think we need to hear any more of that.
I would like to
address
that.
We do need to be respectful on this show, and I want to emphasize that foul language is not acceptable on this program, and neither is something that is racial in connotation. We're going to continue on. Go ahead.
I will. I'll just take a little moment for everybody who heard that. I mean, that is kind of, I think, what Sonia and I are really trying to work against. I mean, that individual who came on just now, the kind of views that he was spouting were very misinformed. That's not someone who's ever gotten to know a person. You know, and it's very easy when removed from people and when removed from their situation to form views that are misinformed, even if they aren't that extreme. So I think that's one thing that I'm very dedicated to. You know, this is one of the reasons that both of us are talking on the radio right now, because that kind of dialogue, that kind of rhetoric doesn't help, you know, and no matter what you believe about people, you quite honestly believe that they should be dying in the desert. You know, not everyone who works with No More Deaths believes, you know, that people should be allowed to come illegally and live in the country or something like that, you know, or come undocumented and live in the country. But what people are trying to fight against here are deaths, you know, ground-level work, working for deaths. So, to lead back to what I was saying before, I was talking about Quixote's and about, well, actually, first of all, Sonia, is there anything else that you would like to say to address that comment?
No, I just think that when we hear comments like that and when we're working with people like that, we always need to make sure that we stand by our guidelines and stand by nonviolent communication, you know, treat everyone equally. Maybe he's had a bad experience with somebody that's made him to feel that way. Maybe not. So it's always important to remember that there are reasons why people have ideas and just try to learn what those reasons are and learn how we can break those boundaries and get rid of some of the myths or things like that that make people feel that way.
Well, we want to emphasize on this program the human rights of all persons.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that this that particular comment goes right to the heart of the UN Declaration of Universally Recognized Rights and the right to be treated humanely and with respect for human dignity.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, the UN treaty that the United States has signed and ratified indicates that all governmental officials must treat persons in their custody and in their interactions with humanity with respect for the inherent dignity of the human person. And when a person is unwilling to respect that human dignity of another, I really believe that they have lost some of their own human dignity in that process. So let us talk a little bit about...
Oh, would you mind if I finish talking about the Quixote's, just as that's
yes,
another...
Yes, go right ahead.
Okay. just because this is another thing that we're facing at the border. As I was saying, one is very vulnerable when in the hands of Quixote. You know, they're the ones that are leading you across the desert. They're very often in control of your money, of your water, of your food. We've had a lot of instances of people, like the family that we mentioned, that are left by their Quixote. You know, very often their money will be taken and they're left to fend for themselves. A lot of people get robbed on the trails. Something else that we see, which is one of the most horrific things of all, is, you know, evidence of a lot of women being raped. And I think one of the most horrific and disturbing things that you can see out there is what are called rape trees. And that's kind of a, you know, a tradition among some Quixotes that after you rape a woman, you'll display her undergarments, hang them up in trees to kind of show that off. And, you know, it's graphic and awful. And, you know, the first time that that happened to me or that I saw that was very unexpected. You know, you turn the corner, all of a sudden you see the evidence right there. And I think I saw a tree with maybe 10 different bras hanging in it. And it's a pretty horrifying thing, you know. And that's just one more thing that's happening to people when they cross a human rights violation that we're trying to work against.
And rape is often used as a means of oppression. And it is a human rights violation and is considered by the United Nations to be both a crime of physical violence as well as sexual violence and psychological violence. So I just wanted to let our listeners know that. We're coming to close to the end of our time here. We have only 8 minutes left. And
wow,
I wanted to remind everyone that this is Dr. Jeanette Parker. We're coming to you live from Lawrence, Kansas. This is the hometown of the University of Kansas, which is why we have these two very competent students from the University of Kansas with us today. Medical Whistleblower is an advocacy network for persons in the medical community who are bringing forward problems and reporting to federal, international, state officials in regards to problems within the medical community. And some of those problems can be those of human rights. Doctors, nurses, medical professionals come in contact with immigrant workers through their treatment, medical treatment while they are in detention, and also as if they are brought to them by persons such as volunteers on the trail or other people they might meet. And also they can end up treating these migrants if they actually do get across and get into the public health system in some manner and then need care. And so these are issues that our doctors in the border areas and all over the United States do eventually confront in some way. So access to medical care and the ability to properly treat patients becomes a major issue for these persons who do not have all the documentation. And they may, of course, have very great medical needs. Brenda and Sonia, do you want to leave some contact information for No More Deaths?
Absolutely. Yeah, go to their website, you know, No More Deaths. I think just type it into Google, No Más Muertes, but the title is just
You better
No More
spell
Deaths.
That for those of us who don't speak Spanish.
Oh, well, just go to
the website.
No More Deaths. Go ahead, Sonia.
Sorry for the interruption. The website
no, go,
is simply nomoredeaths.org.
Okay.
Great. Thank you.
And
thank
they,
you
they
for
also,
being on top of that.
I know they also have a Facebook and MySpace page, too, if people want to support that way or kind of get information that way, too.
And when you want to become a volunteer, girls, how do you sign up?
Go on the
if
website.
If you go to the website, there's a volunteer tab, and you can just click volunteer, and usually they'll have you fill out an application, and so you tell them when you want to come, what you'd like to do, because you can also, you don't have to be working on the border doing patrols like we did. You can work in Mexico at centers that help migrants once they get back to Mexico that have been deported. So there's all kinds of different opportunities for volunteering.
There's also advocacy work in Tucson, you know, working to fight the kind of negative stereotypes that we had, you know, on the show earlier, that, or also just organizing for the organization itself, because it's really expanding, really getting a lot of people involved. The movement is going strong.
You can also donate money or clothes or shoes, blankets, medical supplies, anything like that they're always in need of.
And I bet both of you ladies can tell us how much a gallon of water weighs.
They're so heavy. I think it's like 8 pounds each.
Yeah. So how many pounds of water did you carry each day?
Total, I'm not sure, but I know I would usually try to carry 4 if I could.
Yeah, we had one very intense time when we all just decided that, you know, it was the last water drop of the day. There had been a lot of people using this specific trail. So, God, that day, I mean, this is way out of, you know, out of my usual routine, but I think I carried 4 gallons of water, like 20 granola bars, a couple of things of Gatorade, and something else I don't even remember, but I just remember, you know, aching back, but feeling pretty darn good after all of that, you know, knowing that somebody was going to use each and everything I left out there, and hopefully it would save them.
Yeah, that
and
large drop feels
very tough terrain, very rocky and very steep terrain, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely.
It's not flat.
No. I almost slipped and fell quite a few times. I think I only fell a couple times.
So, well, yeah. It seems that you have many challenges ahead, and both of you are going to be continuing your work to encourage people to understand some of these more complex immigration issues that we're facing as a nation, and to understand also our obligations under the UN treaties. The 2 UN treaties that apply here that have to do with international law. And so whether you realize it or not, when you work as a volunteer for No Mores Muertos, you are also documenting human rights concerns and therefore bringing those concerns to the attention of medical authorities and also to I assume governmental authorities as well. Does No More Muertos provide information to local legislators and congressmen?
Not just local, yeah, not just local. Actually, Sonia mentioned the recent littering charges that migrants or that No More Muertos workers have faced, and that actually, you know, went right to Washington. We've had conversations and audiences with the border czar, with you know, very, very important people, and I wish I could tell you exactly who. Sonia, do you know?
No, but I know that a senator did call and ask them to come to Washington, and they actually set up a meeting to try to work with Borstar and Banwar and all the different organizations, and there was tons of court trials and tons of publicity going on about it.
Well, we've only got a few seconds left remaining. So we're going to have to be clocking off here. But I want to thank you both for joining me. And
thank you, Jeanette.
I'm
really
sure
appreciate
it. You were very informative for our audience. And this is Medical Whistleblower signing off at this point in time, live here from Lawrence, Kansas. And I hope to see you again on our show, 9 a.m. on Monday morning. Thank you all.